Good evening, everybody. You have tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? People who are making a great difference on in the collective, that great big common thought process that we kind of wallow around in. It's being kind of electrified by some people these days. And my guest today is the wonderful Asha Praver. I shouldn't call her wonderful because she's actually humble and she's extremely conscious and has been the devotee of Swami Kriyananda and his side, well, I would say, she's been at his side at times since the 60s doing anything from cooking to teaching to speaking to administrative work, whatever is needed, and has written a book, an amazing book, called Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him. And one thing I just really love about you, Asha, is that you embody a lot of these consciousness teachings and the awareness of spiritual community that a lot of us aim for. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Veronica. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I really love this book, Swami Kriyananda, as We Have Known Him. And the reason I love books anyway, I don't have that much time to read these days, but one of the things about it that's unique is that it's full of, short vignettes about how he had to apply consciousness to various people's situations or your own, would you say?
Oh, yes. You know, to describe that book, I was saying the story of a spiritual teacher is really expressed most truly in the effect that he has on the people around him. And it's not an easy thing to describe that effect, and very often the devotee becomes breathless with adjectives of superlative praise, and at the end, the reader doesn't really know any more than they did when they started.
Well, and I found as I was reading it, even if I just have a few minutes and I'll pick it up, yeah, and it's got like two pages or something, and I find that I personally activate my own heart and consciousness as I read it. To me, that's the greatest gift of this book.
And I can't tell you how gratified I am. I knew Swami for more than 30 years before I even started to try to write that book, because I was totally intimidated by the task, because just as I was saving, I too just wrote pages and pages of superlative adjectives and then just gave up in despair, because I knew that wouldn't communicate to anybody anything except my own enthusiasm. And I mean, that might be interesting to me, but what I really wanted was exactly what you described, that other people would see the practical application and feel, see what it is when you have a teacher like Swami Kriyananda, who happens to be an American, even though he has an Indian name, which makes him even more accessible to all of us who live in the West, is you have the living example of what it means to have expanded consciousness and still interact in a perfectly recognizable way with the world around you. It's not a common example, and it seemed like an important one to share.
I'm going to ask you, I'm going to pick on you a little bit here.
Sure.
You said expanded consciousness, and you met him in the 60s. Doesn't he have an amazingly expanding consciousness?
Well, I suppose expanding is a good word. You know, I met him in 1969. Mm-hmm. I was a hippie. I was part of all of that energy. I was sort of a bad hippie, but I was a little bit of a hippie.
Me too, actually. It was a good time, wasn't it?
It was a good time. And I became very interested in consciousness very quickly, because I could see that that was really what I was looking for. I began to understand that if I could genuinely change my consciousness and not just influence it with substances, but change it in a way that was really my own, then I would have what I'd wanted my whole life. Because what I realized was I felt so confined. And the confinement was my own ego and its limitations. So no amount of anything was going to give me what I was looking for until I changed that.
And you knew that as a young woman.
I came on it pretty early. And in retrospect, I think I knew it all along, but I was in my late teens before I could put words to it.
Well, so how did you meet Swami Kriyananda, who was J. Donald Walters at that point, wasn't he?
Well, he's used both names. He used both names. At a certain point, he decided that being Swami was not entirely relevant to the message, and it was blocking some people's receptivity. So he went back to his American name, because he thought then the message would be more widely received. Hmm. Sometimes, if he's talking about his guru, Paramhansa Yogananda, then Swami Kriyananda is an appropriate name. If he's talking about supportive leadership in an American context, then people are not going to think that a Swami knows anything about it. So the name J. Donald Walters is more appropriate.
So he actually still uses that?
Rarely anymore. But there was a period of about 15 years where he rarely used it in person, but he wrote books under that name. Like, you know, some authors do. They'll get typecast, and so they'll take another name.
Mm-hmm.
And that
a ghostwriter's name. Well, not ghostwriter's, pen name. That's
a pen name, exactly. Yeah. Although it happened to be his actual name, but it was almost a pen name.
but
what we were saying, in 1969, my whole circle of friends were seekers. And a woman who is still a dear friend of mine met Swami Kriyananda because he was teaching in San Francisco and we were living in the Bay Area. And a friend of hers, a neighbor of hers, introduced her, and she called me immediately, and I'll never forget her words. She said, "I've met a real teacher."
Oh, wow.
And she said, "And I really think you'll like him." And so the next opportunity I had, I went to hear him speak, and he came into the room, and what I felt was that I couldn't find the edges of his consciousness.
Hmm.
I mean, most people, even if they're expanded in their awareness, you have a sense of how far their energy expands. And I felt I couldn't find the edges of it. I couldn't expand wide enough to encompass his consciousness. I mean, all of that happened really in a matter of seconds, but it was so unusual for me to be in the presence of someone who's entire aura and magnetism was so different than anything I'd ever experienced. I was instantly intrigued, attracted, and then, quite honestly, I made a decision before he even spoke that whatever it was he had, that's what I was looking for.
Oh, wow. Isn't that amazing?
I'm very grateful to God and all, the whole universe, for bringing me to that moment, because, of course, it was the defining moment of my life. I've never looked back.
Hmm. And he, did he actually know Yogananda?
He lived with Yogananda. In 1948, Swami Kriyananda was 22 years old, living in New York City.
Hmm.
And he was a very serious seeker and had just decided to leave everything and go off and be a hermit. And then under very impressive circumstances, he felt compelled, literally, I mean physically moved by an unseen force, to go buy the book Autobiography of a Yogi, which had only been published for 2 years at that time. And it was 1948. It wasn't like 1969. It's a real different time. As soon as he picked up the book, he felt an instant connection with Yogananda. So he read that book, Autobiography of a Yogi, the same book people are still reading now all over the world. But he had the option, as soon as he finished the book, he got on a bus and he went across the United States to Los Angeles, because that's where Yogananda was living. He found his way into his company, and the first words he said to him were, "I want to be your disciple." And most unusually, Yogananda accepted him as a disciple and initiated him on the spot.
I guess that Yogananda, his consciousness was so immense as well, he would see, know, understand, eh?
Exactly. That's what he said. He recognized his good karma. He spoke of Divine Mother told me to see you. I mean, very remarkable things. Kriyananda says, now, I mean, he uses the modern phrase, he said his mind was blown, his own mind. Because he said a week earlier, he didn't know the word guru. He didn't know the word karma. He didn't know, you know, now all these things are common, but it was all completely foreign. But he just had this instant recognition. So Yogananda lived 3.5 more years, and Kriyananda lived in the ashram in Los Angeles with him during that time.
I just want to remind people, if you have never read it, first of all, this book is tremendous, and this isn't just an infomercial, but Swami Kriyananda, as we've known him, is great. But also, if you have not read Autobiography of a Yogi, it's really it's a primer as well, isn't it? It's a foundational tome.
it's probably the most influential, I would say, outside the mainstream of Western religion. Once you move outside the mainstream of Western religion, Autobiography of a Yogi is just the guidebook or the catalyst for so many people.
And it's so interesting because it's just an easy read that you've written here, and that is also an easy read, but it just reverberates through your little entire being, doesn't it?
Well, you know, that was really what Yogananda was like, and that's also what Kriyananda's like. People think if something is deep, it has to be obscure
mm-hmm.
or painful. But the truth is, there's a childlike simplicity to true spirituality, and that bubbling sense of joy, and deep truths can be made clear. They don't have to be obscure to be deep.
Well, I think real truth resonates on so many levels of consciousness that yes. it doesn't have to be made intellectually complex, does it?
Well, and in fact, sometimes what is too intellectually complex misses the heart.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah,
yes.
You can bypass the heart. Well, I'm very interested in conscious community, and I know let's talk about consciousness and community and spirituality and community and what happened to get Kriyananda's Ananda
right.
community going, and how's that?
Well, when Yogananda, if you to go back to Yogananda, the author of Autobiography of a Yogi, he came to America in 1920. And he was really plowing a hard field to bring yoga and meditation. He was really the pioneer. And he immediately started talking about the fact to everyone, you know, look, if you're really going to do this, you're going to need to band together those of you who, as he put it, who share these high ideals and support each other. So he was always advocating the formation of intentional communities based on shared spiritual practice. He made several attempts in his lifetime, but it wasn't the right time. But Kriyananda picked up that aspect of his guru's work. And when I met him in 1969, he had acquired land in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, about 4 hours from the city of San Francisco, north and east of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And he was beginning to build this spiritual community. And it was, at that time, very early, very fledgling. It was a lot of bare land and a few humble buildings and a lot of eager young people. And we just went out there. Shortly after I met Kriyananda, I just left everything and went to live where he was living and to help build that community. And now it's 40 years later. We literally just had our 40th anniversary on the 4th of July. And now it's 1,000 acres and several hundred people and, you know, charming homes for the individuals, schools for the children, many different businesses, a yoga retreat. It's a whole, like, how would you set up a society if everyone were devoted to the spiritual path? If the realization of God were the goal, what would an American town look like? Village is really the right word.
Mm-hmm.
And so the spirituality that Kriyananda has taught has always been very practical, because that's what his guru taught him, but also because it's been grounded in community.
Mm.
So it hasn't been just a question of, oh, let's take a few monks and go live in an ashram somewhere, you know, let's go to India and live in a cave. It's let's live, you know, in the outside of a Nevada City, California, and let's make our living and let's raise our kids. And
so they do actually have businesses and so on, eh?
Yeah, we have about 30 different enterprises, either community enterprises or individual enterprises.
So it's not committed to poverty or...
Oh, no. We're yeah. not...
checking us.
No, it's a very real question. It's committed to simplicity. But simplicity is... in fact, Yogananda was very specific, Kriyananda also. He said, you know, this is not an age for poverty. This is an age in which spirituality is integrating with what people would call everyday life. And we're not a group that says, oh, then therefore let's all be millionaires. But we are saying that we don't have to live in stables, and we don't have to live without heat, and we don't have to go barefoot in the winter. We don't have to live on nettles.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have to drive Cadillacs either, you
mm-hmm.
know, and we don't have to have, you know, 7,000 square foot houses for two people. But we live in a refined way.
Mm-hmm.
But
what about spiritual practice? Do you gather each day or...?
There are now 7 Ananda communities. I was just speaking of the founding of the first. All of the Ananda communities have group spiritual practice. Some communities are stronger in that practice than others. The Ananda village has a morning meditation every day. Ananda in India, Ananda in Italy. All of our urban communities where I live now, my husband and I, about 20 years ago, came down from the hills closer to San Francisco. We live in Palo Alto, which is just south. And we took over an apartment complex, which had 72 units, and then we have a master lease on it. We don't own it. And we rent the apartments, you know, almost entirely to people who are part of Ananda. And we converted one of the spaces into a wonderful little temple where many of us gather in the morning to meditate or in the evening to meditate. And yes, group practice, either spiritual practice, either as a group or individual, is absolutely fundamental. Because otherwise, you have to have a way for people to inwardly commit themselves to not be so committed to their ego self. You know, communities crash on conflicting desires.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a community with a solid spiritual practice that is genuinely capable of helping people to transcend their pettiness,
mm-hmm.
Everything else follows from that.
What it makes me think of is how many people I talk to who say, I'm getting more and more sensitive and it's impossible to be in social groups and be comfortable. But it seems to me that what you're talking about, then people would radiate a common vibrational self, wouldn't they?
Oh, Veronica, that's exactly what it is. And when people first come into our community or to the temple that we have here or any one of the Ananda communities, most especially Ananda Village, because it's so big, you can just enter into this whole world and stay there for months, really. But it is like the whole vibration is different. And the vibration is supportive of a more refined consciousness. And everybody around you, I mean, people are people. It's not like everyone who moves in immediately becomes a fully enlightened being. I wish it were true.
Oh, darn, yeah.
Yeah, rats. I feel just the same way. But everybody's facing the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And
what happens if you have a little karma between two people? What happens then?
Believe me, we all have a little karma. As Swami Kriyananda put it, in some of the stories that I tell in that book, and some of them were my own, you know, like I'm over it now, but there's this woman in the community, and she and I just had this horrible relationship with each other. We just loathed one another with an intensity that was hard to fathom. I mean, now I look back at it, and I think, what was going on? But the truth of the matter was, we had been mortal enemies. And the only dream I've ever had about a previous life, I dreamt about her and I dreamt about just this awful things that she did to me. And I believe it was true. In fact, Swami Kriyananda said it was true. So she, you know, just to match me, she went somewhere and got a psychic reading and she found out all the horrible things I did to her, which I also believe were true.
Huh.
And we were sort of getting like really into this. Swami Kriyananda, and I tell this is one of the stories in the book, he says, first of all, he said, this is a very old spiritual family. I mean, the souls that are drawn to be part of Ananda, we've been together for many lifetimes. And he said, we've been many things to one another. You know, and it's easy, you know, just from looking at normal life, you can see how people who are close, often if they're very close, sometimes feuds develop, jealousies develop, antipathies develop. And if you accept reincarnation, which I do, you can see how those things, I mean, what if two men are in love with the same woman and one man takes the woman away? What happens to the third man, the third person, the second man in that? What happens when he meets them all in the next life? How does he feel?
Hmm.
You know, all of these antipathies over a long period of time can really build up. And I believe that woman and I really had that. So first he said, look, we're drawn together for many reasons. And I had this strange feeling about her that much as I disliked her, I also loved her intensely.
Isn't that interesting?
It was very interesting. I didn't like her at all, but I considered her one of my best friends in a most peculiar way, which I think was just the karmic memory. But then Swamiji said to me, to us, he said, what we were doing is we were beginning to use those past actions to justify our present feelings. Well, of course, I dislike you because 700 years ago you did X or Y to me.
You little creep.
You little creep. He said, those revelations are given to you, but the way he put it was this. He said, neither of you would be capable of that kind of action now. So you're not relating to the person in front of you. You're relating to your own memory of somebody who no longer exists.
Hmm.
He said, because you both suffered intensely from the wrong things that you did. And you've learned the lesson. So even though you remember each other treating each other like that, that's not who you're dealing with now. And he said, those revelations are not given to you to justify your present bad feelings, but to enable you to escape from them. Otherwise, you just perpetuate the karma.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just go on and on.
So the karma is actually this rolling emotional feedback of reaction,
exactly,
rather than any kind of intelligence.
Exactly. That's exactly right. It's a subconscious, well, deep from your chakras, memory, mm-hmm. commitment of fear, anxiety, hatred, revenge. And I mean, we probably played that out many times when we were both still capable of being pretty horrible. But by this time, you know, she was a perfectly fine, even a very compassionate person.
Hmm.
You know, there was nothing in the present. It was just a past memory. But he was very stern with us. You can't use this to justify yourself. You have to use this to extricate yourself.
Well, so tell me this, Asha. How long did it take you to, how long did it take you to take the sting out between each other?
15 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's a deep thing.
Oh,
you know?
Sure, it was a deep thing.
I know when people have amazing mystical experiences or near-death experiences, sometimes it'll take 12 to 15 years to actually turn it into wisdom. So I guess that's kind of par for the course.
It's par for the course. You know, but what we have to understand is it's progressive. It's not horrible and then suddenly you're free.
Mm-hmm.
It's that you come in like the tide. Every so often a wave goes really far, but then you lose that gain, and then you come in again.
Hmm.
So the thing about the spiritual path, certainly I found it true over now almost 40 years, is everything just gets better. It's not like you don't have difficulties or karmic antagonisms or tragedies or anything like that. This is no free ticket to a soft life. But what it does is it gives you tools for dealing with it, which is everything.
Well, I think it's just wonderful. I mean, I'd say this, did he recommend that you meditate together, or did you both go to the morning meditation or whatever?
We did better when we weren't together a lot, although mm-hmm. circumstances of our lives brought us into intimate contact every day for maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years.
Funny how that works.
Yeah, funny how that works, right.
Yeah. There's something I was thinking how fascinating this is, because most of us, probably all of us, deal with relationships as a really, it's the major issue, isn't it? So what about leadership roles in your community? How did the Swami advise you about that?
That's an interesting question. One of the things that Swami Kriyananda, I really think, has to contribute to the world is a genius for leadership.
Hmm.
And he's one of the things he has done, which is unusual in spiritual circles, is that he's trained a great many leaders, and he's also given, even though he's the center of a spiritual community and by every right, you know, has the right to be almost an authoritarian figure, instead he's given as much responsibility to people as they will take.
Hmm.
And so he's trained a whole very expansive generation of leaders. So he's 83 now. He'll be around for a few more years, he says, but even when he passes, Ananda will continue probably for quite a long time because of that. And the essential...
Are you saying that he trained leaders for Ananda,
for
or
Ananda.
Did he train them for anything else?
Well, he wrote a book called The Art of Supportive Leadership, which actually has been bought and distributed by quite a number of major corporations in America.
Wonderful.
It's a small book. It's a J. Donald Walters book.
Hmm.
And The Art of Supportive Leadership. It's a, mm-hmm. It's a real jewel.
Hmm.
But my experience of his leadership has been exactly that. It's been artful, and it's always been supportive. He has a knack for being able to figure out, you know, what a person can do that's positive and what an honest next step would be. And so whenever one deals with him or has dealt with him over all these years, whatever difficulty you bring to them, he always gives you something positive to do that you actually can do.
Hmm.
One of the little stories in the book, this is a very brief one, but a woman came to him, and he had given her a challenging instruction, and she came back to him after a couple of months and said, "Sir, I need to be sincere and honest with you. I have to tell you what you asked me to do, I simply can't do. It's beyond me to do it." And he just, without missing a beat, he said, "Well, so much for theory. Let's deal with reality."
Oh, really? How adorable.
And then immediately said, okay, given that that's how you feel, then let's do... And then he made some positive suggestions. And his thought had been that the woman, you know, didn't necessarily have to experience the certain karmic trajectory that she was on.
Mm-hmm.
But then it turned out that she did have to experience it. And when he saw that that was what she, you know, was going to be compelled to do, that was fine. Then let's just support you through that.
Well, that's wonderful. So, and what about the lawsuits? There were some suits and so on, and it was very interesting in the book how he dealt with that.
Oh, well, starting in 1990, Ananda is, let's see, the history of religion in America, which, you know, America has, we live here, so we don't think about it so much, but America has this extremely unusual religious history in that people start churches all the time in this country.
Hmm.
You know, our friends from Italy who came over to visit, I mean, they just couldn't even comprehend the idea that you could start a church. To them, there is the Catholic Church, and that's that. We, here in Palo Alto, our temple is actually a Catholic church that we bought from the Catholic diocese here. Our Italian friends, again, they couldn't even comprehend it. How can you buy a Catholic church? But this is America. So in America, usually, in the history of all, you know, these innovative religious groups, is that there's somebody starts it, and almost always 20 years or so, usually after the original founder has passed away, there's a split among that next generation. Either somebody's kicked out or somebody leaves voluntarily. And then all of a sudden, whereas there was only one, now there are two. And there's always some theological dispute behind it. And usually, it's usually the original tries to persecute the renegade out of existence. So Paramahansa Yogananda started something called Self-Realization Fellowship, which is this worldwide spiritual organization centered in Los Angeles. Kriyananda and a woman named Dayamata and other disciples grew up with Yogananda, grew up spiritually in Self-Realization Fellowship. After 10 years, almost exactly, after Yogananda died, Kriyananda was the only man in a leadership position among like 8 or 9 women.
Oh,
and
wow.
He was so like on a different wavelength from everything that they thought they should do. And all the directions that Yogananda had given him, he'd never told the women. And they just thought he was in it for himself. They couldn't understand the expansive creative energy of an extremely expansive creative man. So basically they expelled him in 1962. And they thought, as soon as they expelled him, he'd just go away, that without their money and position and Yogananda's organization, that he would disappear. But he didn't. He started Ananda, and he began to thrive. And Ananda really began to rise. And by 1990, they were so upset by it that they sued Ananda and Swami Kriyananda on the basis of copyright infringement and trademark infringement and unfair trade practices. It was, you know, like calling ourselves disciples of Yogananda and using his teachings and his pictures was an infringement of their exclusive right to these things. And, you know, from a certain point of view, we were doing all exactly that. It litigated for 12 years, if you can believe that.
Wow.
And in the end, they lost everything. They lost. They went in with the whole world believing they owned this teaching, and when they came out of it, all of their trademarks had been nullified, many of their copyrights had been nullified because it was false.
Hmm.
And also, Yogananda's teaching is for the world; it's not meant to be a sectarian thing. Now, in the middle of that, which is also what I wrote about in the book, when the trademark copyright case was just disintegrating, our lawyers told us that there's only one way that they could get this stuff back, and there's a legal concept called tarnishment. And if Ananda could be proved to be morally reprehensible, and therefore any association in the mind of the public between Ananda and Self-Realization Fellowship would tarnish, by association, Self-Realization Fellowship, then the court might reinstate their exclusive rights. So, not too long after that, a woman who'd been part of Ananda suddenly filed a lawsuit. She'd had an affair with a married man in the community. When the man went back to his wife, Kriyananda supported the man, naturally, in staying with his wife. She was furious. She got herself connected to Self-Realization Fellowship, and I have to say, with what we believe to be their backing, we have very strong evidence, but it was never proved in court. What we believe to be their backing, she filed a sexual harassment suit, claiming that Ananda was not, in fact, a bona fide religious organization, but this really scuzzy cult in which women are systematically abused by all the leaders. We made a slight mistake because the charges were so transparently false and so utterly preposterous. We had no idea how bad it could get before it was over. So we went.
How bad did it get?
It got really, really, really bad. She got a lawyer who has figured out. I don't know if you've ever been in court. This is a long and very interesting story. I tell a lot of it, but I'd never been in court before. I thought court was like Perry Mason.
I was just going to say, I've seen it on TV.
Yeah, we all think it's like TV. It takes about 30 minutes, maybe 45.
With the commercial here and there.
Yeah, and you get up there, and then the witness breaks down, and the truth comes out, and the judge rules in your favor. And actually, in fact, in the copyright case, which was before a different judge in a completely different court, even though it took us a decade, in fact, the truth came out. It just took a long time and millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars. But in this case, the judge was not clear, and the lawyer that she had working for her, the legal system is designed for people to tell the truth, for lawyers to tell the truth and for witnesses to tell the truth. And if you don't tell the truth, the means of uncovering that, and especially enforcing against a lawyer who is dishonest, it's almost impossible to do. So we found ourselves in a position where we were facing a lawyer who was dishonest. And so in the end, we were actually more or less judged reprehensible, not completely, but a lot of it went against us. I will never serve on a jury because juries don't actually know a lot of what's going on in a courtroom. And by the time it was over, it was so distorted that if we had appealed, we would have won immediately, but we were virtually bankrupt. And also, all you get when you win an appeal is that you get to have another trial. And we would have been right back in court with that same lawyer, even conceivably with the same judge. So we just wiped the dust off our feet and walked away. So, you know, there's still people in the world who believe that we are not what we seem. But
So how did Swami handle that? How did he handle the... the pressure and the...
He remained utterly untouched by it. He took it seriously, and he said to us, you know, if it was just me and my reputation, he said, I wouldn't even bother to defend myself. He said it so sweetly. He said, I'm not here to defend my ego. I'm here to overcome it. He said, I know who I am. He said, freely admitted, he said, I haven't always done everything right in my life. He said, but as he put it, I'm proud of who I am. He said, I've faced everything I've had to face, and I'm proud of the life I've lived, which I love that. And said, I'm not here to defend it. People can think whatever they want. However, he said, if he hadn't defended himself, all of Ananda would have come down with him, and so that wasn't fair. He couldn't do that to us. But he was just always perfectly calm. The whole trial took place right near where we live, and so for weeks at a time, he and many of our friends just lived in our house. And we'd have breakfast every morning together, and we laughed a lot. And we laughed a great deal through the whole 12 years of litigation. We had many, many, many very, very happy times, right, you know, an hour after something got awful had happened in court. And because there was no reason not to. You know, life gives you lots of different opportunities. Some of them are very pleasant and some of them are not. And also, as I write in my book, Swami Kriyananda, and the people persecuting him had been his closest friends at one point. And he said just very simply, I choose to love. He said, if I allow myself to be angry with them, he said, I've lost twice. I've lost their friendship, and then I've lost my peace of mind. What is the point of it? So his example to us all the time was, you know, we need to stand up for ourselves. And we did. We stood up for ourselves very strongly. Partly, you have to. In the American legal system, if you don't fight back, you lose by default. So we had to fight. We had to fight very hard because they were fighting really hard. But we always fought honestly. We never once bent the truth even slightly, ever. But we always fought cheerfully, and we were never fighting against the individuals. We were just fighting against an untruth. And oddly enough, when a lot of the verdict in the trademark religious case went all for us, virtually all for us. In the sexual harassment case, it didn't go for us. And when the verdict was read, I had the oddest reaction, and I've always thanked Swami Kriyananda for this. My first thought was, oh, that poor woman. Not only has she lied so egregiously about something that she should never have lied about, but now she's won. And I thought to myself, you know, it's going to take such a long time before she balances this karma out. My first thought was just great sympathy for her, which I still have. I mean, I just think she's made such a mess of her life by doing something so dishonest.
Isn't that interesting? So you know when deep in your soul, when your ego hasn't grabbed in a defensive way, it's such a relief, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Well, I tell that whole story because it's part of our history, and Kriyananda's heroism through it was really astonishing because he was just being... And it was all in the press. You know, it's all behind us a decade now, but it was quite an adventure when it happened.
Yeah, I have some vague memories of something. But...
Oh, it was big news when it went on. And it was sort of fun because, you know, it's one thing to believe in something when everybody's telling you that it's a wonderful thing to believe in. And to be part of something when everybody thinks it's great. It's quite different to be part of something that's being vilified in the newspaper every morning. And it's even more interesting, you know, to have a jury of your peers, so to speak, to tell you that you're completely brainwashed and misguided. Because then you get to stand back and say, I wonder what is the truth? Why am I doing this? I never tried to persuade anybody that we were innocent. I gave people, and I never tried to hide any accusations or facts. I would tell anybody anything. I'd answer any question they wanted. And then I would just say, well, what do you think, you know? Here we are. You've experienced it. What do you think? And if they couldn't feel it for themselves, then, I mean, what good would it be to persuade them?
And what exactly is brainwashed, you know? It's a kind of interesting question, isn't
it? It's a very interesting question.
So give us your thumbnail on that, Asha.
I think brainwashed is what everybody is. They look out at this world and they think it's real. I think that's the real brainwashing.
That's where the stand-up comedy comes in, right?
Yeah, really. That's brainwashing. I mean, what spiritual life does for you is it puts you on your own two feet. You have to stand up for the truth as you know it.
Right.
It's the exact opposite of brainwashing. I mean, they don't even know if brainwashing really exists. It's such a ridiculous thing.
Well, I have a lot to say on brainwashing, but I don't want to waste your time with that, because I've got other things to ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
One is the East-West Bookstore in Palo Alto.
That is
an amazing place. Now, is that not part of Ananda?
Yes, it's you know, legally speaking, it's freestanding, but in fact, it's operated by Ananda, everyone involved with it and so on.
Did it run through the 12 years of litigation?
Oh, yes. East West has been East West Bookshop was there in the late 60s when I first started.
Well, how was its business when you were on the front page of the paper a lot?
It didn't seem to hurt it at all. I mean, business went just because it stands alone sufficiently. Every so often something unpleasant would happen. But for the most part, people either were not aware of the affiliation or didn't care about the affiliation, because it's the premier metaphysical resource, spiritual healing resource in the whole area, and people were not going to, and they would walk in there and would just feel wonderful. You know, there was no...
Oh, I know. I've been in and out of there a whole bunch.
Yeah. It's brought a lot of people to the spiritual path. It's been a wonderful work for us to run that store, because Ananda itself offers one teaching, which is Yogananda's teaching through Kriyananda. That's who we are. But East-West can offer all paths.
Many paths, yeah.
And so therefore, people from all directions and all persuasions can find a next step there. And so
where do Ananda, the people in your community, where do they work generally?
About half of us are in some Ananda affiliated, Ananda-related work. We have a community manager. We have a number of people, half dozen people who are on the staff of our temple. East West has a significant staff. We also have a school for children Living Wisdom School. We run a preschool through eighth grade school, and that has its whole staff of teachers.
You have one in Palo Alto as well.
We have one
in
Palo
Grass
Alto.
Valley.
Yeah, in Grass Valley they have, or they go all the way through high school. Ours just is a lower grades through middle school.
And do you have a lot of healing practitioners and that sort of thing?
And we have a number of healing practitioners. And then the rest of the people who live in our community just do all the different jobs that you would do here. We have a few doctors, and we have lots of computer people, people who work in the tech field, who work for NASA, and just everything that's in this area. So you can do it either way. So, and then they just come home at night to this lovely family, spiritual family, and we serve dinners. People come only if they want to. I mean, nothing is required. But we have dinners together, we have meditations together, and you're just, your neighbors are your friends.
Hmm. Who organizes it? How do you stay organized?
Well, we don't make too many rules. Yogananda said, don't make too many rules, it spoils the spirit. So we're small enough to just go in a flow, and we organize just by, we don't have a formal consensus, but we more or less organize by consensus. We organize what we call ourselves, the word dharma means right action, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we call ourselves a dharmocracy.
Oh.
Because we all sort of recognize what the dharma of a situation is.
Oh, that's great.
So we don't have to have a lot of complicated negotiations. We talk a lot. We communicate. Mm-hmm. And we
do you have,
ideas.
Like, a council for working out difficulties?
People don't believe us, but we so rarely have difficulties. We have no system whatsoever for working out difficulties. I mean,
I'm
four
impressed.
Decades. Well, it is impressive. It's very impressive, and it's factual, too. As I say, people can dislike each other,
mm-hmm.
but only rarely do people even have an argument. Because when those energies start arising in people, their first thought is, you know, let me pull back and see what I can do to calm myself down first.
Hmm.
The first thought isn't, if I can assert my will over that person, then I'll feel better.
Mm-hmm.
The first thought is, let me gain mastery over myself, and then I can look at this situation from a more centered perspective.
Well, assuming that Swami Kriyananda can't be everywhere at once.
Yes, exactly.
What are the classes? Is there a series of classes or what?
Oh, yes. At Ananda Village, we have a retreat called the Expanding Light. You can find all of these. If you go to ananda.org,
mm-hmm.
it's the beginning, and you'll find the Expanding Light retreat or anandapaloalto.org, which is where I live. And because we're like an urban center,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, and our main work is this temple that we have. And so we run classes every night of the week, and we teach meditation is one of the primary things we teach, and we teach people what they need to do to take initiation into Kriya Yoga, which is the specific, extremely effective meditation technique that Yogananda taught. And so we prepare people to take Kriya initiation, which is a very wonderful addition.
Mm-hmm.
And then we teach classes in basically every aspect of life considered from the perspective of, what if I'm trying to live a spirit-centered life? How would I relate to my work? How would I relate to my marriage? How would I raise my kids? And then all the esoteric of that, the chakras, kundalini, prayer, devotion, chanting. It's a very big program. And on all of our websites, especially Ananda Palo Alto, we have not only all the classes listed, but almost everything is recorded and posted, and can either be purchased as a CD or downloaded for free as an MP3.
Hmm.
So the ministry not only is geographic, but it's actually worldwide at this point.
And so you do teleclass. People can learn online.
People can learn online. Yeah, and that system is less formally developed, but people can learn online in that anything that happens is available online.
Hmm.
And then they can communicate if they wish.
Now, do you have a store also? Do you have anything to do with Renaissance Books in Portland?
Renaissance Books in Portland is run by Ananda. It's a private business, but the people who own it are very very active in the Ananda community in Portland.
That's what I thought. So you have it's a related community then.
It's related. It's strongly related. The couple who started it and have always run it are very close with Ananda.
Oh my! And do you tend to all know each other?
Oh yeah, we all know each other.
Isn't that wonderful?
One of the things this community gives you is, I have friends all over the world. Ananda is very strong in India and very strong in Europe. And now with the internet, You know, well, I've been teaching extensively for decades now, and ever since I've started posting what I do online, I correspond with people from every continent who are just pulling the stuff off the internet, and it's just marvelously fun.
That's great.
And it's very gratifying, of course. One does an enormous amount of work just effortlessly.
Wow, isn't that wonderful? One of the things that I noticed that I really love, and I mentioned this to you yesterday by phone, is that the Swami refers to everyone as his friend.
Oh, yes.
And there's some wonderful stories. I can't think of which one offhand. I should have marked them, but where he takes the sting out of situations by... I remember one story where something about writing about a woman who actually was working against him. I don't remember.
Oh, yes. Well, that was about the whole SRF controversy. When he wrote his own autobiography, he wrote about Diamanta, who later became just, you know, utterly determined to bring him down. Mm-hmm. He wrote about her in such a loving and supportive and praiseworthy way that, oddly enough, to a large extent, he created in the minds of most of the people who knew him a picture of her as this noble person. And later, when the whole lawsuit happened and many things came out, I said to him, "Sir, you knew even then that she had this complete other side to her nature." He said, "Yes, but what I wrote was also the truth." And he said, "She's my friend. That's how I would want to be. That's how I would want to present her, and that's how I would want to be remembered by her." And it's just, I said, "You were working against your own cause." And he said, "The only cause I have is truth. And every word I wrote was true."
So it's as if he teaches that the interactions between himself and the external world aren't the truth, right?
Truth is dharma. The truth is righteousness. The truth is bliss, really. Anything that you do that separates you from the universe and that sets up a dissonant vibration, basically you're working against your own interest in that, because sooner or later that dissonant vibration is going to come back to you. Anything that causes you, I mean, look at the example of Jesus Christ. He's on the cross. He's dying on the cross. He looks at those who have crucified him. This was not a good thing for these people to have done.
Right.
And all he thinks about is how unfortunate this action is. So he says, "Father, forgive them." He prays to God, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." And he's trying to intercede on their karma. And now Jesus was beyond needing to free himself, but he sets the example, because everyone is equally loved by God, and everyone is equally a part of God, and even more, everyone is equally ourself. From the extent to which we separate someone out and call them bad, ugly, mean, unkind, well, if they are bad, ugly, mean, and unkind, you can say that they are, because if they are, they are. But if you also correspondingly have hatred in your heart toward them, then that's when you're bound.
That's when you stay on the wheel.
And that's when you have to learn compassion.
Hmm.
But, you know, masters are very strong, and they'll take strong action, because if a person is behaving badly, you don't serve them by not standing up against that.
Yeah, there's a story that you have that's very sweet. It's about... somebody who was really distressed, and he was very compassionate and held her or whatever, and then the next person sees that, so presents her distress, and he's very cold with her.
That was me.
Tell that story. I love that story.
Well, I came to visit Swamiji, see him, because he had given me actually it was a writing assignment. I had a lot of trouble writing, and I was simply not able to do it. And I was just wanting to just tell him how miserable I was, really. And I came in, and he was counseling someone else prior to me, and he was being very sympathetic. The woman was in tears about some personal matter, and she was crying, and he was just comforting her. It was so sweet. And, you know, after she finally gathered herself up and he said a very sweet goodbye to her, it was my turn to talk to him, and I was all ready for exactly the same treatment. And I just sort of presented my dilemma, and he was, I think this is when the time was. I was actually sitting there, and I began to weep. And I cried a lot more in those days than I do now. And I expected him to sort of, you know, comfort me, pat me on the back at the very least, say comforting, sympathetic things. And I realized that he had actually moved away from me, and he had gone over to a bureau, and he had opened this drawer, and I knew what was in the drawer. What was in the drawer was half-used flashlight batteries that had been placed there so you could test the voltage to see if there was enough in it to make them still worthwhile to use. We didn't have electricity then, and flashlight batteries were really important. And I realized he was testing the voltage on his flashlight batteries. I mean, that's a job you do when there's, like, nothing else to do. It's not something you do. And here I am having what I think is this important life crisis, and he's testing his flashlight batteries. And I, you know, you would think that would be a horrible thing to do, but this man is had been and is the soul of consideration. And so, you know, I was just astonished. And I sort of made, you know, a few efforts to get his attention, sort of said, well, I guess I'll go home now. And he said, goodbye. And I just walked out. But what happened was I was just so, like, mad that I hadn't gotten any sympathy, that it kind of, my anger kind of revved me up, and I tackled the project and I just did it. And I did it well, and afterwards he, you know, commended me on doing it well, and then later at a gathering of the whole community, he said, Asha faced a very important test this week. He said if she hadn't had the courage to face into it, essentially she would have, I think he even said, I would have gone off the spiritual path.
Oh,
He said, and there was nothing I could do to help her. She had to do it herself.
Oh, my. So he's really perceptive.
Yeah. And afterwards, I said, why didn't you tell me how much was at stake? He said, I didn't think it would help.
Oh, well,
and I
bless
said, well, you're probably right. It would have scared me to death. But he knew exactly how to treat me.
Wow.
You know, because on other occasions, he's been very soft and sympathetic. But in that case, and then he said later, in another context, which I included, he said, as a rule, compassion is a good idea when somebody's telling you about a difficulty. He said, but sometimes if you're too compassionate, it just increases the thought in a person's mind that they have a really big problem.
Wow. And our problem now is we have to end this, as much as I'd love to carry on.
Mm-hmm.
But listeners who have enjoyed this, and I'm sure there are many, can get hold of this book, Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him, or go to aswehaveknownhim.org. Is that right?
aswehaveknownhim.org is a whole website about the book. AnandaPaloAlto.org will also lead you to the book. Ananda.org will lead you to the book.
Well, you are a pleasure to be with, and as a just in your own right, you've got a wonderful light, and I thank you so much for all the wisdom you've shared with us today and the enjoyment.
Oh, Veronica, I've totally enjoyed this hour with you. Thank you for asking me.
Me too. Many blessings.
Blessings to you.
Wow, this is Veronica Entwistle, and I feel kind of lifted. I feel very blessed by that last interview. Asha Praver is quite a diligent. We're all seekers listening to this show, aren't we? And she's really done a great job. Lots to learn from her and this wonderful book. Next week's paradigm shifter is Linda Sherman. I just love her astrological doodah, and I don't know what she's going to say about the latest political events, but we're going to hear next week on Paradigm Shifters. Thursday night, I'm going to be with Jackie Salvitti, and we're talking about an amazing, with the team at 8 o'clock Thursday night, we're going to talk about how it's a web. Every belief that we shift and change is attached somehow to other beliefs and the radiance of it all. And, you know, Spider-Man's in fashion, ladies and gentlemen, and we are all it. I said to her yesterday, I feel like going into the now, I'm in the center of a web. We're just being playful, but we're also being deep and rich, and we're unfolding our clarity and purity and humor, and we'll see you then. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, if you'd like to be in touch with me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com for a session, a private session, or if you've got suggestions for Paradigm Shifters or feedback on either of the shows, I love to get your notes and your messages. Let's all take a little love and run it through from the universe, through our hearts, and appreciation for one another, and send it back out. Much love to you all, and thank you for listening.